Now, these criticisms periodically actually got him in trouble with the government and with Catherine personally, who reminded him regularly to behave himself. But one can't really speak of any decisive break with the establishment. He's not a complete dissident in that sense. In fact, his relations with Catherine were relatively good, though they sparred occasionally. She continued to support his publishing work financially. He couldn't have done it without her help. And her goal was to create a vital cultural life in the country, one bringing new ideas, one with a gentle sense of criticism of problems. And this seemed an appropriate way to by supporting Novikov's work. She also liked to support things that were a little less dangerous, such as his efforts to publish various historical documents. This was useful knowledge about the past. But also, he began to publish Western works, literary classics, and again, make these accessible even to ordinary literate Russians by having them be inexpensive publications. Again, relatively harmless, useful activity. Equally important, though, in understanding why this was not a total rebel we're talking about, is his attacks on the system were not, his attacks on problems in Russia were not attacks on the system itself. He wrote, to be sure, some of the most biting criticism of social abuses, but he did so above all to appeal to people's consciences, to appeal to his fellow nobles, to appeal to the state to make improvements. And what was the substance of this appeal? Because looking at it a little more closely is, I think, revealing. Roughly as follows. His ideal for the state was to create a truly patriarchal monarchy, a monarchy that would be raised above particular interests, that would unite the whole nation, that would serve the common good, which, of course, is exactly what progressive-minded monarchs like Catherine the Great intended to do. And the source of this idea was partly an echo of a rather familiar European 18th century notion of enlightened absolutism, such as you could find with Frederick the Great of Prussia or Joseph II of Austria, for example. But it was also rooted in this Russian tradition, now increasingly secularized, of the Tsar as a caring and loving ruler using power for good, the ideal of the Tishaishi Tsar that we've talked about. Likewise, when he criticized the nobility, his idea was not to overturn everything about their system, but to convince nobles to act in a caring role, a paternal role toward their peasants, not abuse them, not exploit them, but care for them, such as in times of bad harvests or floods, to teach them. In other words, his goal was a moral revolution, to transform how people thought and behaved, not a social or political revolution, not a transformation of the system itself. Very different, as you can see, from Pugachev, and indeed also very different from what would become the later style of the intelligentsia, which was demand a change in the system as a whole. Now, I shouldn't simplify this. To really understand Novikov, it's important to note that he never stopped searching for answers. Frankly, he was quite unsure of how far to press his criticisms. And then came the Pugachev Rebellion, 1773-4. And this showed him something he hadn't suspected before, the real depth and ferocity of people's anger, also the brutality of common people, as well as the cruelty of the state in suppressing this rebellion. And of course, the failure of either the rebellion of the peasants or the suppression of by the state to really make life better for anyone. He became convinced at this point of the utter futility of revolution, the utter futility of the use of force, and this led him to still seek more intensely solutions to the evils that had provoked the rebellion and some means of healing the wounds. And it's at this point that Novikov joined the growing Masonic movement in Russia. This was in 1775. And I want to pause over this phenomenon for a moment. Freemasonry was extremely popular among young, educated nobles in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in Russia, as in Western Europe and North America, for that matter. And it tells us something about their ways of thinking, their ways of feeling, even. Now, let me simplify a bit by describing some of the essential elements of this, at least in the eyes of Russians like Novikov. Basically, a Freemason was expected to assume a sort of double obligation. First of all, a duty to himself to develop his inner spiritual resources. 18th century Freemasons believed that all human beings were created in the image of God, a rational, divine being, and thus by nature, all human beings were imbued with a basic sacred dignity.